Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
The first recipe book that we know of in history is about 3,000 years old. But what was it? And where was it found? We're going to find out all about that and a lot more today on A Taste of the Past. Well, the very first cookbook that we know of in history is, well, sort of euphemistically known as the Babylonian cookbook, but it's a lot more than just a cookbook, and or a lot less than just a cookbook, and we're going to find all about that today when we talk to Nawal Nasrallah. Nawal is a native of Baghdad, and she is an independent Iraqi scholar and a food writer, and she has written the second edition of her wonderful book called Delights from the Garden of Eden, a cookbook and the history of Iraqi cuisine. And she is also the author in the Edible series of Dates, a Global History. And Nawal, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
This book is truly not just, I don't even think of it that much as just a cookbook. It is a textbook.
Well, thank you.
I enjoyed the first edition because of all the information. But, of course, this book I love even more because of all the wonderful photographs.
Right, yeah. because I knew that I wouldn't be able to have pictures or, it won't be pictorially, kind of attractive. But I wanted it to get out and to be seen because I had so many things to tell the world about, my cuisine, its history, its culture, and it was really not known. The only thing they knew at the time, of course, that was 2003, Iraq, Kuwait, politics, and I wanted people to see the other side of Iraq, our culture, our food, the bright side of our history. Mm. And that was my chance. I said, so many people told me that, well, don't write a book about, that big, divide it, recipes, and history later on. I said, no, I want it in one piece.
Well, especially for culinary historians, for food historians, for researchers. I mean, you have done a lot of the digging for us, and it's wonderful.
Thank you. I wanted to put everything about the Iraqi cuisine in one book. I don't want the recipes in one part, the history in the other. I want them to be in one piece and to be enjoyed, as a whole meal.
Well, what is so nice about the book, too, is that you share a lot of your personal stories.
Right.
And also a lot of poetry and folklore. And
everything. And, oh. Everything. Caricatures, songs, folk tales, anything.
Starting from the beginning. I thought in a half an hour, how can we do the entire history?
I know.
We cannot. But, but we can talk about the roots of Iraqi cuisine. Yeah. And, of course, without leaving our listeners in too much suspense, we can talk about that Babylonian cookbook.
Right, yeah. Of course, when I first started thinking about writing the book, it was meant to be a cookbook, like with recipes. But when I started to see all those nice books written about other, cultures, I really started to be jealous. I want this one for Iraq. And I said, I can do it. It's not going to be just cookbook recipes. I want to put all those nice things also, related to the recipes. And in my research, I was the first one really to benefit from my research because I came to know so many things. And when I saw those Babylonian recipes, I said, oh, God, what is this? Where was this? Where was this hidden? And I was really worked like a crazy, telling everybody, look, I found this. Look, I discovered this.
Well, and the Babylonian recipes by and large came from the cuneiform tablets, right?
Right, yeah, because that was the way of writing. It was, you know, not they didn't write the way we write nowadays. They used clay tablets, and they used to make impressions with a kind of wedged, you know, like pencil, and they dried it. And sometimes they baked it. That was some of them stayed. The other ones just disintegrated mm-hmm. when they were unearthed. And the result is that we have only three cuneiform tablets written in 1700 BC, and it is believed that they were written in Babylon. We have only three cuneiform tablets.
But a lot of information packed.
A lot of information packed in this. Despite the fact that the recipes were, you know, not like the recipes we know today, you know, with the, all the details of time, of quantities or so, but still, it gives you an impression how civilized, advanced their cooking was. I mean, who would have thought that in 1700 people would make something similar to chicken pie filled with something like bechamel sauce? Hmm. Really, they really deserved the attention they got when they came out in the 1980s. You know, the story of those recipes is that they were found around the 1930s, and I think some people just read just a few words and they thought they were pharmaceutical, tablets. So they were put in drawers to be later on studied. And then Jean Batero, the French archaeologist, when he started deciphering those cuneiform tablets, he discovered that was a cookbook. I mean, and he worked and worked until his findings were published in 1980s. And, of course, they made a big noise, you know, when they first came out. They were translated into English, and some of the recipes were even cooked. Following those recipes, the French journal Actuel in the at the yes. time they cooked this chicken, this bird pie. You know, I cannot say chicken because chicken came to the region in the first century BC, so that was pre-chicken time. So, but they used birds like francolin and so small birds. So they baked this according to the recipe, and they thought they took photos for it, and they thought it was a wonderful dish.
and these tablets, they do assume that the reader has a basic knowledge of cooking techniques.
Right. Yeah, you are right. I mean, that was not meant as a teaching guide. Of course, I mean, we have to remember that writing at the time was not like, you know, most of people were illiterate. And writing was difficult. They had to learn so many symbols. It was a kind of a profession. So, and you don't expect the cooks to read like we nowadays, you know, read. There was no reading public like we have today. So it is, I think it is rightly assumed that those cookbooks were, you know, for the record, just to put down. I mean, the ancient Sumerians were fond of records. They used to make records of everything. And, of course, why not cooking?
Yeah.
But also, I think, it's also, I mean, the fact that they did take the time and the effort to put down those recipes, that they, you know, they recognized how distinguished their cuisine was. And they wanted to, you know, keep it for posterity.
Preserve it and pass it on, indeed it has been.
So it was not only just a mechanical recording of things, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was this element of a pride in their cuisine and, you know, kind of showing off, look, we have this.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of elements of pride, what about the elements of the cuisine? What do you consider to be the basic elements of this cuisine which has persisted to today?
Stews, I should say, you know, because in Iraq today, this table dish is stew. It
stew.
Has always been. When I read the medieval cookbooks, so many of them, the basic dish was a stew. I was really surprised that one of the cuneiform tablets was totally dedicated to stews.
Huh.
It had 25 recipes.
And we're talking about a tablet that's not a whole lot bigger than
your hand. Let me tell you about how I, you know, how my experience at Yale University, the Babylonian tablets.
That's where they're housed, right, at Yale.
After writing in these, you know, I only had experience looking at them in pictures and magazines. So when we were on our way to New York, we decided to stop at the museum. And I wanted to look at those, recipes, so to speak, you know, with the cuneiform tablets. So we went there, and the curator, she allowed me, she opened the, you know, the case, and she allowed me to touch the cuneiform, this cuneiform tablet. Yeah. Oh, my God, I cannot tell you how did my feelings when I laid my hand on this. It wasn't big. It was like the size of the palm of the hand, so smooth, and it was kind of tan. With all those tiny impressions, you know, those. And these were supposed to be recipes, the first documented recipes in human history worldwide. And I said, I am holding it in my hand.
Wow.
And look what happened.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it was written on both sides. So I started looking at first side. And of course, as a habit, I turned it from left to right. And she was looking behind my back. She said, no. This is not the way to turn the leaves of the cuneiform tablet. You flip it from bottom to from bottom to top.
Oh.
I said, oh, my God. I didn't know. Who would have thought, you know? That?
Yeah. Interesting.
which makes sense. I mean, if you are holding a cuneiform tablet in your hand, I mean, why would you flip it from left to right?
You just take two hands and flip it, and then right again.
Well,
then foods were continued to be mentioned throughout the later history and tales. Well, even more tablets that were found with the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, and foods are always mentioned there.
Yeah.
So, what are the elements of that you feel are really
staying permanent?
Prominent tastes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the things that let me tell you first of all about what they found and what those cuneiform tablets were. They were three. The first one was totally given to, as I said, to stews. The second one dealt with bird recipes. Some of them were served with porridges. The other, and some of them were made into pies. And the third one was heavily damaged, but it has two hints that also tells that, you know, something about the origins of certain of the traditions we still follow, culinary traditions we still follow these days. Let me talk about the damaged one because it is short and then go back to the longer ones. Mm-hmm. Yes, this short one, I saw that there's a reference to, it's not a complete recipe. It deals with dough, you add meat to it and you bake it. This is exactly like lahma ba'jin we make. You know, lahma ba'jin is like they call it the Arabian pizza.
Mm-hmm.
We have a flattened bread with some meat topping on it. In Iraq, we call it khubz arug, which is the same idea, but we mix the meat with the bread and we bake it. So I see the beginnings of what we have always been doing, you know, in thousands of years ago.
Mm.
And the other one mentions something which is called butumtu. French Assyriologists didn't know what it was, but to me, coming from Iraq, it rang a bell. Butumtu it sounds similar to butum. And I know butum is terebinth berries. Terebinth berries, they belong to the same family, to the pistachio. So they are kind of nuts. If you crack the shell, the hard shell, you get a very nice, kernel, which tastes like pistachio. So I thought that if you add this nut to the dish, this is something we always, you know, we have been doing. This is a Middle Eastern thing. We add nuts and raisins, for example, to our dishes. This
mm-hmm.
is... So that's, you know, I found this very significant. And when we come to the chicken, of course, pies, I found certain recipes similar to those chicken, bird pies in the medieval books. You know, they were, in my book, I mention certain, you know, I translate some of those recipes and they show the similarities between how things really endured. You know, cooking birds, of course, later on chicken, the same way. But let's come to the stews. That is one of the most important techniques, which shows, an advanced stage in cooking. because grilling, of course, there's no variety in cooking. You put meat. I mean, what can you? I mean, you can brush it with oil. You can brush it with something. But the variations are limited. But with a stew, the limit is the sky. You can add anything, you know. All kinds of cuts of meat, all kinds of vegetables, all kinds of thickener agents, all kinds of colors. I mean, it's the infinite variety of a stew is really that shows the beauty of this cuisine. Some of the recipes in this cuneiform tablet about the stews only had meat. Some of them mixed meat with vegetables. And one of them was even vegetarian. Oh. It didn't have meat, you know, it was turnip stew. But the thing they do, I mean, they don't just boil those meats or boil those vegetables. They cooked. Yeah, you know, they don't just put things on the stove and then forget all about them, you know. But they show that the cook had to tend to the pot. There are several stages where you need to add certain things. First, you add with the meat, for example, but you have some of them. Sometimes in some of the recipes, you get rid of the first boiling and you use a fresh change of water. They want to get of all unsightly particles, you know, how when you boil meat and all this froth comes out.
So
they
were concerned with presentation
with
as
the presentation,
well,
right? Yeah. It's kind of aesthetic things, you know, the beauty of the dish. So they get rid of all the things. And then after the meat starts boiling, they would season it with the onion, with leeks, with garlic. Onion, leeks, and garlic, they're in all those, like we do today. Yeah. We cannot cook without onion. And then, of course, comes the stage of adding the herbs and spices. You know, most of the spices we use today, they used back then. And even in names, they are similar. Hmm. Like cumin, kamun in Arabic, kamunu. They used to call it kamunu. We call it kamun. Coriander, it was called kizibaru in Arabic. Nowadays we call it kizbara. Saffron, we call it now zafaran. It was called asupiranu. So, you know, you can even recognize the names of the dishes, of the spices they used at the time. And they used these things with control. For example, one of the recipes would say, don't put much. Put just a little bit. So, there are, you know, although those recipes were really not detailed like our recipes, but when something breaks or makes the dish, they mention it. For example, there is a dish in which cured meat is cooked. They mention the time because it's important. I mean, meat is already cooked. It doesn't need a lot of cooking. Right. So the recipe would say, put the meat, when it just starts to heat up, take it away from the fire. You know, they were really, you know, they mentioned the things that are really important.
Well, it's interesting to know that it wasn't just for sustenance that they were consuming food, that they really cared about taste.
To gratify their taste buds, like a showmanship.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, just to discuss a little bit about the Mesopotamian diet, they had, you mentioned, a lot of the meats and the vegetables.
Whatever you can think of, you know, it was available, like grains, of the grains, they have wheat and barley. They had lamb, mutton. They even, at the time, they ate, you know, pig's meat. It was, of course, not prohibited yet. And they had all kinds of vegetables, all kinds of fruits. So we can assume that the diet was balanced and it was, you know, bountiful, of course. For those who, of course, as we know, of course, in old times, those people who have money would enjoy a better
cuisine.
They
have everything, yeah. Right.
And the poor people, of course, they would eat more vegetables. Because in one of the sayings, the Sumerian sayings, that says in the stomach of the poor Sumerians, there aren't much vegetables. So if you are so poor, you wouldn't even afford the vegetables, which are so cheap. So it was just you know.
Well, now, you, of course, did a lot of research on the date palm because you wrote the book, The Global History of Date Palms. And that was the first domesticated fruit that we know of from that area, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was it is said that it was the, you know, the place, the Mesopotamia, where the first, where it was first domesticated. Because it was wild, of course, as we know, but then it was started to be domesticated in the Mesopotamia, then Egypt, and then, of course, when Alexander the Great came, they took the dates with them, like, to India, and they said that the date palms in India were the result of the all the seeds that were thrown by Alexander the Great soldiers.
Could be.
Yeah, why not?
Right. Yeah. And milk products. What about milk products? They didn't drink milk, right, because there was no refrigeration. But.
That's one of the reasons, because it wasn't really quite popular. But I assume they drank, but it wasn't popular because it went bad because of the hot weather. It went bad very quickly, but they had other means of preserving it. They made it into yogurt. They make it into cheese. We have records that tell us they knew how to make about 20 kinds of cheese. Clarified butter, you know.
That keeps forever.
Yeah.
Right. And fat, well, you mentioned stews, but fat was very important to them.
Right, right? Yeah.
A lot of fat in the
they
stews.
I figure
it's a lot of, it's high in calories and they needed calories.
They needed the calories, but also in cooking stews, you need the fat so that you can, you know, cook the food and, you know, prolonged cooking without really toughening. Drying out the meat. And there are many kinds of, they use several kinds of fat. First of all, for example, we have the samn, which is clarified butter. I mean, samn in Arabic, samnu at the time, the clarified butter. But this was used mostly in pastries. What they used for their stews was the fat tail of the sheep. Yeah, that was really the prize.
Right.
Yeah, and when I talk about the tail's fat, you know, the sheep's tail fat, not many people know what I am talking about. So I had to show the kind of sheep we had and we still have in the country. Most of the fat in the sheep is concentrated in one place, of course, which is good because the meat won't, you know, it will be leaner. The fat will be accumulated in just one place,
and
which is
throughout.
The tail.
Yeah.
And it is a huge chunk of a pure fat, delicate fat, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, Herodotus, we know his exaggerations, but he said he went to the region and he saw some of the sheep, they had so large, you know, tails, those fat tails, that they needed to put them on carriages with wheels so that they can be carried.
And all of these things, it's amazing that they stayed. Yeah, that you endured through all the different influences. There was the Persian influence, the Ottoman, you know, reign, and the Ottoman Empire.
They all had this tail's fat, you know.
Yeah.
And the way they ate it was that they rendered it, you know, and then they used it up until the 1960s or something. I still remember my mother, our neighbors, everybody used to use this rendered tail fat to cook the stews.
Hmm.
It was mainly used for savory dishes.
Right.
You know, the clarified butter was
for
used
pastries.
For pastries.
Which we will talk about when we come back after a brief break.
You're listening to Let Me In by Snow Mine on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef,
pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hi, we are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Nawal Nasrallah, and she has her new edition out of Delights from the Garden of Eden, a wonderful book, and we're talking about how the food really hasn't changed a whole lot in 3,000 years.
Not really, surprisingly, no. I mean, at least the basics.
Right. And before the break, I was talking about how it's amazing the flavors, the cooking techniques, the foods that have endured for all that time throughout all the different influences and reigns and powers and the Ottoman Empire and all that time.
Right.
When did the major transition take place of Iraqi food in your mind?
The transition from modern, medieval
to modern times.
Well, you know, we say that all those traditions endured, but when you go to an Iraqi house, you would see that they are cooking stews, you know, with tomato sauce. We use tomatoes. So I can say that, you know, we had a kind of revolution in our kitchen around the 19th century or so, when people started to realize that tomato is not harmful and started to spread until it came to the Middle East. And people, of course, they were so delighted with this fruit. It's fruit, right?
Up for debate.
Of the nightshade family.
Right.
Yeah. Because before that, they used to have a lot of things in order to cook their stews. For example, for color, of course, yellow was the most popular color. They used saffron. If they wanted green, they had to squeeze all kinds of vegetables like parsley, Swiss chard, coriander, extract the juice to make their stews green. Red wasn't really that, you know, they were not interested in red.
Mm-hmm.
They liked their stews to be sweet and sour. So for sourness, there were different options, like sour fruits. They use lemon juice. They use all kinds of citrus fruits, and also they also realized that there was something in the fermented sauces they used to make at the time. In medieval times, it was called murri, but it was the same sauce that was made in ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Rome. Of course, different names. In ancient times, the difference is that they were fish-based, but in medieval times, by medieval times, they learned how to make them cereal-based, which I think they felt more comfortable
fermentation.
With.
Fermentation.
They used to mold bread deliberately in order to use them for making all those sauces. And we know that those sauces, they have this kind of umami taste that add depth to the food. So instead of that, they had the tomato. It has all these things. It has the color, it has the sourness, and it has this umami taste. So I think that's why people don't know murri these days. You know, we stopped preparing those. They were time-consuming, and we stopped doing these things. We have the tomato.
Yes. Well, you know, I wanted to step back a little bit, back into the medieval period, but to talk about street food.
Okay.
It's odd you think about medieval times and street food, but medieval Baghdad was known for its wonderful street food.
Right, yeah. I mean, they used to say that people used to go carry out food, and because it was cheaper than cooking at home, because the fueling wood was expensive, you know, for people. So it was easier to go and buy kebab or grilled meats and all kinds of sambusa, all kinds of, you know, fried foods, desserts like zalabia, like lozinaj, I always say this is the precursor of our baklava, the baklava.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So it was really, a booming market for street food. And people would just go. Not only that, not only grilled meat, but they used to, for example, go for what we nowadays call pacha, which is the boiled heads, tratars, tripe. They used to put them in large cauldrons and let them simmer during the night so that they'll be ready for the morning for, you know, early workers. They would have a hefty,
hefty
meal before their... yeah, but street food at the time, you know, if you go to the high class, it had a kind of stigma. Because it was cheap, of course, it was not fit that for, like, you know, a high-class person to be seen, to be caught eating these things. But they liked it, and they went, but still.
Well, it's interesting. Now, so much of the food that they liked, of course, were, you know, was a rendition of a homemade product.
But, yeah.
And when you go into your...
Now we are talking about this. You know, we have the same... street food also has the same stigma.
It does.
No, today. But it's not as good as home-cooked food.
It's the opposite, right.
So that was the other thing why, you know, people were discouraged from eating.
Well, they had communal kitchens and communal ovens as well. So, certain things were not available to them all the time, I'd imagine.
Breads, for example, there were different kinds of bread. Tanur bread, the tanur is the domed clay oven. Every household had this oven, and they used to bake the flat breads with nice bubbles on them, you know. But there were other kinds of bread they couldn't bake at home. It was called furrani. It was baked in the community, like a commercial brick oven. And these they also used to buy. They didn't make at home.
Well, that's the very first chapter that you start with in your own recipes.
Right, yeah.
And that's breads, the glory of life.
The glory of life, yeah. What are we without bread?
That's right. And you brought two beautiful breads for me. I'm going to photograph them before I rip into them and put them on. In the recipes that you chose to include in the book, tell me what you chose, why you chose them, and what they're... you know, the representation.
The recipes for this program?
Yeah.
Or for the
book? No, in the book.
In the book. Well, I chose them.
Rough.
Well, generally speaking, these are all the dishes we cook, and I wanted my book to, as I told you, to be inclusive. Everything, you know, you need to know about the Iraqi cuisine, I put it there. Even, you know, certain things that I don't expect people to cook every day, such as the stuffed lamb, you know, for trying the recipe, I couldn't get a stuffed lamb, so I stuffed a turkey, a large turkey, in order to try the recipe. I thought that was my my better option. But still, you know, I mean, everything is tested, and, you know. So I chose whatever is Iraqi.
Uh-huh. And the pastry section, of course, is your pastry section is to die for. So look at the pictures and I drew.
Yeah, well, because I like pastries.
Right. Tell me, so you chose a couple of recipes to talk about in particular that you thought were significant in the cuisine.
Well, the first one is a fish dish, which in Iraq, we especially Baghdad, we call mazgouf. Mazgouf, even the etymology of the word, nobody has really fathomed what it really is. But I think mazgouf comes from the way the fish is grilled, because it is suspended on wood, you know, pieces of wood. And the fishes are arranged around a camp-like fire. Mm-hmm. And the fire is lit, flaring fire, you know, with the flames, so that the inside of the fish would be cooked. That's the first stage. And the second stage is to lay flat on the back, on their backs, on the dying fire, so that the fish would cook nicely. This is a process that would take about an hour or so. The fish usually used in Iraq is shabut, which is a carp family. It belongs to the carp family. Mm-hmm. But when I tried it for the book, I used salmon, and it worked really, you know, it was good. It worked fine. I chose this recipe for the program because I think that the same dish was cooked even in ancient times, because in cooking dishes in cooking fish at the time, they use certain cooking terminology that suggests the same way of cooking. For example, they said First, the fish is licked by the fire. So we assume that there's a flaring fire, you know, like licking on the fish. And then they say, lay it on the fire. So those, you know, two stages. And it is the kind of fish that whenever, you know, foreigners come to the region, they would really have to introduce to it. And they like to taste it. And they wrote about it. And in my book, I write about what the foreigners said about this dish. They said some funny things. For example, they would tell you when you go to Baghdad along the River Tigris, they prepare this fish for you. They would tell you you have to eat the fish with your fingers. the reason, of course, the practical reason is that because river fish, especially, you know, in Iraq, is infested with the small bones as fine as, you know, like pins, you know, like needles. And you have really to be careful. You have to to feel the fish with your fingers before you put it into your mouth. But one of the writers said, he said, yeah, well, this is the reason she gave me. But I also heard that they said eating fish with your fingers is like having making love through an interpreter.
Well, that's a good one. We'll go with that. There was another recipe you wanted to talk about that you felt was something that has endured.
Well, there are more than one, but now I choose the cookie. Nowadays we call it kletcha. It is the national cookie of Iraq. And people, you know, we love it. And, of course, other Arab countries, they cook something similar, but it's called ma'mul. We call it kletcha. But, of course, we have our own spices to add to it. And so when I started my research, I was really surprised that how ancient this cookie is. We have, if we go back to medieval times, we have cookies, a recipe for cooking, for baking it exactly like we do it nowadays. But of course, the name is different. That's why people do not recognize it. It was called khushkananaj, which is a borrowed Persian word which meant dry bread. It is dry because they are dry cookies. I mean, we know that these are dry cookies, and these are, if you want to go to Hajj, if you want to go to travel far away, you take a bag full of those cookies because they stay for a long time. They are not like, you know, delicate and greasy that. Okay, now back, you go further back, we go to ancient Mesopotamia, and we learn that they made the same cookies, more or less, of course, but it was called kuluppu. Kuluppu, of course, once again, nobody knows what's the meaning of this, but I have my own theory, is that, you know how we make, when we use molds for making those cookies so that you have nice impressions on the face of individual, wooden molds.
Like a stamp.
Stamps. So I think it was called kuluppu from the word qalab, which is mold. Kuluppu. Or from kul, because they were round. They made round in celebration of the of the goddess Ishtar. They made it for her, you know. They made it for her for the new year, which is in April, like Nowruz, you know, this time of the new year. And we still, you know, it has always been the cookie to cook for the Eid, our feasts, the religious feasts, medieval time, and even today. If you just look at the history of this cookie, this is enough to tell you, you know, how enduring cuisines can be. And, of course, this is the chance for having those records, the Babylonian tablets, the medieval cookbooks, and, of course, our modern practices. This is a unique chance for people to see how a cuisine, any given cuisine, can develop, you know, throughout the centuries. Yes. You do not see this. You don't have, of course, the information enough to do this about other cuisines. But here you have documents, you have records in order, you know, to see this.
Yeah, that's what makes it so fascinating. Yeah. It truly is. Thank you. There's too much information. There's so much information.
Yeah.
It is wonderful, and we'll have to have you back to talk more about the next more modern phase. But
yeah.
I encourage listeners to read the book, and Delights from the Garden of Eden. It is both a history book and a cookbook.
Half and half.
Half and half, right. And Nawal Nasrallah, thank you so much for sharing
welcome.
Your time.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure having you.
And
I've been your host, Linda Palacio, A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.